What we're going to do is we're going to read from Luke chapter 6 just to set the tone, set the scene. Karen was just about to read it for us. So Karen, go for it and then we will learn.
In these days he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them the 12, whom he named apostles: Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon who was called the Zealot, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And he came down with them and stood on a level place. A great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him and healed them all. And he lifted up his eyes on the disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, and when they exclude you and revile you, and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so their fathers did to the prophets."
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much. We're thankful for God's word. I want to just pick out a couple of things about this passage. And what I see here is a kind of three-dimensional approach of Jesus and his ministry and how he went about the task of making disciples. And we're told that on one of those days, Jesus went on a mountainside to pray. He spent the whole night praying to God. And when morning came, he called his disciples to him. And what I want to suggest this morning is a pattern of Jesus discipleship, disciple making, as being three dimensions, going in three directions. Jesus helped his disciples to look upwards towards him and his Father. He called them into relationship with him. That was the outset of his disciple making journey. "Come follow me," Jesus said. That was the first invitation. Okay, before you will do anything, before any activity, first of all, you're invited into relationship with me. Come follow me. And we see in this passage in Luke 6 how the upward dimension of Jesus' discipleship involved prayer. It involved teaching. In other places, we see a kind of solitude, retreat, worship as well. But Jesus was trying to point his disciples upward as well. But it wasn't just that, okay? So they weren't just it wasn't just all here's information or here's teaching. There was also other dynamics going on. And what Jesus did was he was also building and creating a community. So he invited in. And here in Luke 6, we see that actually the group of people are named. In Mark chapter 3, it says that when Jesus called the 12, he came close to them. He invited them close. He invested in a few. And so we see Jesus here building and creating a community as well. From verses 13 to 17, he formed a community, and I'll use that word as well. But it doesn't stay like that either. So Jesus wasn't forming just a holy huddle or a cozy club. There was a purpose, and there was to be an outward dimension to their discipleship. "Come follow me," Jesus said, "and I will" what? "I will make you fishers of men." So do you see the following here, the making here, the transformation that's going on? There's another word for this part, okay? There was a transformational community or a transformational process even to Jesus. And then here there was what you could call this mission, witness, but there was to be an outward dimension. They reached out to a world in need. And Jesus was engaging his disciples in a community that would flow out. And then as they flowed out, what were they doing? They were pointing people back to God. And for me, I came across this a little while ago, and for me, this has been a really helpful lens almost, or a tool for me, to assess parts of my life, to assess the activities of a church, to assess even a small discipleship group or relationship, to help think through. So for discipleship for me, I don't necessarily think of as simply curriculum-based. Here's a course and we need to take people through. I often think about in those who I try to invest in those who I try to lead, whether it's in a church context, whether it's the small group in the church that we lead in, whether it's individual disciples who I work with. I try to think how I can expose people to each of these three dimensions. In fact, I try to think first about how I'm leaning into this first. So how am I reflecting these three dimensions in my own following of Jesus and my own faith? How am I growing in my devotion? How am I developing in terms of my relationships with others? And how am I reaching out to a world in need? And then how am I trying to model that to others or inviting people in? And it's been said before that, I'll use a different pen. It's been said before that sometimes most churches or most disciple-making ministries are often strong in two of these three things at any one time, but perhaps more weaker or more limited in another one. So if we're really good at the up and the in, but not so good, if we're really good at the in and the out, so we've got a kind of community, we've got some activities, we've got some activities that reach out as well, but we're not really helping people to look up, if we're not really teaching them, if we're not really pointing them to Christ, then actually if we miss the up, we become lost, or people get lost.
So they don't become lost, we become liberal, okay, sorry.
So we miss out in teaching them about Jesus, but we're doing activities, we're doing nice things, we're a nice community, but it's not really pointing them to Christ. Perhaps we've got some churches who are really good in the up, and they're really good at the in, but they're not so good at reaching out. They've got a strong community, they're teaching their people about Jesus, there's strong spiritual formation perhaps happening, but they have no out. And they become limited. They become limited. It's kind of a self-serving community, and maybe it's more like a reservoir than a river, if that makes sense. There's no life kind of flowing in or out of it. People aren't reaching out. And then there are some perhaps disciple-making movements or churches or at times in what we do where we're maybe talking, teaching people about Jesus, and we're maybe keen to reach out, but we're not so strong on the relational piece. We miss out on that. Then actually what will happen is that disciples will get lonely. They'll get lonely. They won't have examples to imitate. They won't have people who can invest in and support them and pastor them and be a role model to. And I guess as we begin today, I wanted to set that out at the outset, not as the only way to view a kind of model of Jesus' disciple-making ministry, but to give you a framework and a lens, almost for you to self-reflect on your own disciple-making, for you to consider of whether, by the way, lost was okay. I thought I'd messed up my L's, but anyway, lost or liberal, you could say for that. For you to consider maybe which of these you're weaker in or more limited in as well. And then for you to consider how would you go about developing that and what elements of key discipleship principles that you might need to invest in. There's one other thing about this passage, and then as we go through today, it'll be fairly conversational. So I'll teach little segments, and then I'll get you to maybe reflect on your own or discuss with others, and you can feedback as well as we go. But one other little thing, the thing about Jesus here in Luke chapter 6 is that he was really intentional. He was really intentional. You see, at this point in Luke chapter 6, there had been a few people, a few disciples or a few interested parties who'd begun to gather around Jesus. He'd begun to teach. He'd been visible. And people began to gravitate. There seemed to be this larger group of people who were following Jesus. But at this point in Jesus' ministry, Jesus decided that this would be a really important point to be more intentional. And what he did was he did these three I's, or how could we follow what Jesus did? How can we be intentional? I think in terms of our disciple-making ministries, we need to think about who we can identify, who we can invite, and how we can invest in them. Jesus did that here. He clearly identified, because they're named in the Gospels. Okay, there's actual people, they're actual names. It's not just there were a few people who were around Jesus. And it was so important to Jesus that he spent the whole night in prayer beforehand. So he didn't just pick them because he liked them or because he thought they were just there. He spent time in prayer. And then out of that prayer flowed an invitation to some specific people to come closer into his life, to learn to follow him and to become his disciples and go on to be his apostles. He chose and he designated, I think that's the word in my translation, whom he also designated. So there was an intentionality. He identified people. And then he invited them into something. And then he worked out how to invest in them along the way. And his investment lasted for a period of 3 years as he taught, as he ministered, as he brought them along with him, as he gave them opportunities as well. And as we think about discipleship, disciple making in our lives, perhaps that's the starting point. Perhaps it's prayer. Perhaps it's saying to God, and maybe as we, walk away and leave this place, maybe it's, we can be overwhelmed at times, particularly those who maybe lead churches or ministries or organizations, and we see the crowds, we see the programs, we see the schedules, we can get bogged down in the strategies and all of the finances and all of the things that go on. But what if we were able to identify some specific people who we could identify, who God might be identifying in our lives? That's not to say that Jesus, from this point on, ignored the crowds. He didn't. He still preached. He still taught. He still ministered. Come on in, if you wish. Nope. That's right. He still ministered to the crowds. He still had compassion on the crowds wherever he went. It's been said before that Jesus loved everyone equally, but he didn't invest his time equally. He loved everyone equally, but he didn't invest his time equally. So who could you identify? Perhaps God is just through his Holy Spirit drawing you to some people, putting some people in your heart. And then what could you invite them into? So for some of us, that could be a kind of more formal discipling relationship. It could be, hey, would you be interested in meeting with me for a period of time? It might be to begin a kind of smaller group where people could disciple, you could disciple a group, or they could disciple one another as well. It could be into a specific opportunity, even of service, actually. And then alongside, as they serve, you try to invest in them as they do that. But I think you need something specific to invite them into. It could just be to come around your home and your life in a more informal way, but still in an intentional way as well. Jesus identified, then he invited, and then he invested. You see, Jesus never asked you or I to build the church. He never asked you or I to build the church. That wasn't the job that he gave us to do. Some of you are thinking, I've heard that verse in the Bible before. I'm almost sure that's in the Bible. Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. It's interesting, I think the longer I've traveled in ministry, the more temptation I have felt to try to do Jesus' job for him, to build the church, to make it seem better, to develop more activities and structures, and when actually in reality, I wonder if at times we can try to end up trying to do Jesus' job for him. But Jesus gave his disciples another job to do. First of all, the invitation for his followers was to remain in him, to come follow me, to learn how to be good followers first, to remain in Jesus. But he also gave them a commission. Disciple making for Jesus was the first invitation and the final command. First invitation, Mark 1, come follow me and I will make you fishers of men. Matthew 28, go make disciples now of all nations. And what Jesus was saying was the journey that I have brought you on for the last 3 years, now it's your turn. It's over to you. The things that you've seen me, heard me teach and seen me do, now it's your turn. All authority in heaven and earth is given to you. Now go and make disciples. And it strikes me, and it's been said before by someone else, not me, but you know, if we focus our lives and our time on building the church, we won't necessarily make disciples. It's not a given that we'll make disciples. You could build up a church with activities and structures, and as I call it, we could build up the ABC, you know, the attendance and the buildings and the cash. And we could, you know, try to build the church, but not necessarily make disciples. But the reverse, whenever we spend our lives and our time and our energies and our efforts making disciples, that will always help to build up the church. It's a question of where we're putting our focus and our energy and our investment. A book called The Trellis and the Vine says this. It's a brilliant book. The image is the vine in John 15, of how that is the kind of work and the invitation that Jesus gave to his people. And at times there is a need for a trellis to structure that as that grows. But this is what the author wrote. I'll start to quote it another way. Structures don't grow ministry any more than trellises grow vines. Most churches need to make a conscious shift away from erecting and maintaining structures and towards growing people who are disciple-making disciples of Christ. Structures don't grow ministry. Building the church doesn't necessarily make disciples any more than trellises grow vines. You could have a do you know what I mean by a trellis, actually? A kind of structure that might hold a vine in place. You could have a beautiful structure. It could be well maintained, well painted, really well reinforced. But if it has no fruit on it, if it has no growth, then it's not doing the job it was intended to do. Most churches need to make a conscious shift, they argue, away from erecting and maintaining structures and towards growing people who are disciple-making disciples of Christ. Now, please don't hear me or that book wrongly. They're not arguing that structures aren't needed, okay? But it's a question of what we put first and where we place the most of our attention and focus. To give you one example of this, we realized as a church that many of our meetings as leaders, I'm an elder in a kind of large church in the suburbs of Belfast, and we realized that so much of our meetings, this is maybe going back a year or two ago, so many of our meetings were focused on what we call the three B's of buildings, budgets, and bums on seats. Okay, so we were so focused on processes and strategies and finances and staffing issues and all of that stuff that we realized that we weren't giving enough attention to talking about the ministry that was actually going on through the church. And so we had to make changes to our meetings. We had to ensure that prayer was placed more at the center, that our meetings weren't just functional, but they were prayerful. We began to invite some leaders in the church who coordinated key ministries to come in and give reports or to talk about just how things were going. We began to talk more about how we could actually create strategic ways for us to develop more ministry. You know, I would love us to consider today whether we're building the church or making disciples. As we go through the next section, what I want to suggest, how we might make some shifts towards developing a culture of discipleship. So in some ways, where we've started today is a little bit about how we can invest personally in the work of disciple making. And so I've got five shifts. I'm looking at the time. We'll probably get to do two this side of the coffee break, two or three maybe this side of the coffee break, and then we'll return and do the other two or three, and I'll get you to discuss them. And then I think before we finish today, what I might do, I might leave it to the end. If you're following the notes, I've skipped a kind of introductory section, but we might use that as the end today to think a little bit about what we've learned sort of post-pandemic and how we step into discipleship beyond it as well. But I'll use this little diagram here. This is a 1 degree shift. If you make a change of direction of 1 degrees out of 180 degrees, it doesn't seem like a very small shift, okay? You've probably moved, if I'm pointing this direction, I move 1 degree. I'm probably pointing this direction. But the longer you travel, the bigger the shift or the bigger change that will create. So if I take one step, I haven't changed very much. If I walk a mile, I've probably moved maybe, several meters. If I walk for a year, I'm going to be in a completely different place. And the example of this is that if a plane is taking off from Los Angeles, okay, it's from the west coast of America, and it is flying towards Florida. So in my mind, in my map, okay, in the map in my mind, that is straight across, okay? But I know the world doesn't always work like that. But anyway, in my mind, that's straight across. They're heading for Florida. If the pilot makes a 1 degree shift as soon as it takes off, that plane lands in Canada. So you're in a completely different place than when you took off or you started. And people often talk about, we need to change this thing completely. We need to make a 360 degree revolution, or we need to, whatever it is, turn 180 degrees in our course. But actually for me, in working with churches, I find the language of 1 degree shifts quite helpful, because it's often encouraging them to make small but significant shifts or changes. But the longer that trajectory and you follow that trajectory along, actually that can create and change a culture, and you can end in a completely different place. So as I share this today, think about how you could each be making 1 degree shifts in some of these things. And maybe the 1 degree shift is how you speak, the language you use, little things that you could do, a program that you could change, an activity that you could invest in, people that you could draw alongside. The 1 degree shift can be significant. Okay, so the first shift is this. It's from viewing discipleship as optional to understanding it as absolutely essential and critical for the life of every church and every believer. It's about, I believe we need to help every single believer and every single person in our churches to understand that they are a disciple. To be a Christian is to be a disciple of Jesus. There are no special subsets and extra special layers for the super spiritual. Okay? To be a Christian and to be a disciple, they go hand in hand. In fact, in the New Testament, the word disciple is mentioned 269 times. The word Christian is mentioned 3 times. And those three occurrences, 2 out of those 3 occurrences, people are using it as a nickname about the Christians, the Christ ones. See those people over there? It's almost like a figure of mock or a term of mockery, those Christ ones. But the basic New Testament understanding is of people who follow Jesus being disciples. And so discipleship is not some kind of optional extra for the really keen. And that's often how we advertise things. It's like everyone comes along on Sunday, and then if you're really, really, really keen, super keen, you can come along to this group or this course and you can get the extra knowledge. Dallas Willard writes this: the disciple of Jesus isn't the deluxe or heavy duty model of Christian, especially padded, textured, streamlined, and empowered for the fast lane on the straight and narrow way. How can we help everyone see themselves as learners,
It's the original kind of meaning of the word disciple. Mathetes, Greek word. Mathetes, learner, to be a student. And that means no matter someone's age or stage, there's always more to learn. How can we see them? And therefore, as we do that, we are trying to put across the point that everyone needs discipleship. This is for everyone. This is not just for some or the special few. You see, if people think discipleship isn't for them, then they will opt out of discipleship activities because they think it's not for them. It's not optional, it's essential. And, you know, we see that, I've mentioned this already, the first invitation, the final command of Jesus. You know, this is what he gave his ministry to. And I've said already, you know, that sometimes church leaders, the danger is that we get so consumed and caught up with ministry activity that we miss out on the basic work of making disciples. And as Karen's pointed out already, of course, we still need to give our time to the kind of structural work. But I would strongly argue that if some of our time is not being invested in the ordinary work of drawing alongside individual disciples to try to encourage them, then I think we're missing something. I've heard some church leaders tell me, I would love to focus more on discipleship, but I'm either just too busy, you know, I'm just too busy and I don't have time to set aside for it. Or sometimes even say, you know, I'm here to pastor the whole church, and so I don't want to be seen to pick out some special people or to be seen to show favoritism. And again, I just say Jesus loved everyone equally, but he didn't invest his time equally. And I think there's some kind of aspects of discipleship that if you're worried about that as a pastor or a church leader, you don't have to advertise everything. You know, you don't have to advertise everything. I'm in a church, and I don't mean this in a bad way or a negative way, but I don't know what my pastor does for 50, 60% of his time. And by that, I mean, I generally know what he does. But he's going and meeting people. He's visiting in hospitals. He's visiting the sick. I don't know what that is. I don't know who he's meeting with every week. I don't have a schedule of his time. And so sometimes I think there's things that we can get on with and do. And the other thing about the kind of busyness that I've seen some church leaders do really well and model really well. They know they are busy, but what they do is they invite people into the ordinary activities that they're already doing. I think I was talking yesterday in our network of a church leader, or another network actually, of a church leader who once a week joins some of his congregation on their commute into the city. So he gets up at the same time as them. He gets the train with them. He's with them for the 30 or 40 minute travel into the train. They have conversations along the way. He knows that's his day to do that. And then he sometimes says he gets a coffee and goes home, but as they go about their work. But he's joining people with them, or he sometimes goes and joins people on their lunch break. So rather than him thinking, oh, I need to find an extra, you know, time to meet with these people who are working, he's saying, what are they doing and how can I join them in that activity? And he said it's given him a whole new lens for seeing what people in his church, kind of the ordinary grind of the working week. He says he has conversations about what's going on in the office, and he's able to speak into some of those things. What are you already doing, or what are other people already doing that you could draw alongside them in as well? It's been said before, churches are about the ABC, attendance, buildings, and cash, but how can we be about the D, E, and the F of discipleship, evangelism, and fellowship? There, I'll give you that line for free. Okay, but it's not an optional extra, it's essential. One more quote from an American Presbyterian called Steve Smallman. He says, in the broader understanding of discipleship, it is certainly appropriate to have special study seasons or specific programs designed to help people in their walk with Christ. So he's saying, at times we need to draw alongside, you know, or to draw in extra resources and courses and study seasons. But, he says, we should be aware that along with specific ministries that might be labeled discipleship, everything in the church should be viewed through the lens of making disciples. So that brings me back to, how is the preaching shaping disciples of Jesus? How is our pastoral care giving us opportunities, not just to care for people, but also to help them think through the big issues that they might be wrestling with or preparing them for as well? The activities that you brought up in your church in Slovakia, the activities of the church, how are they contributing towards the work of discipleship? It's not that our activities are key and we need to add on discipleship. It's that discipleship is key and other things become the lens with which we view it through as well. Discipleship is the foundation on which everything else grows. I see it as the fuel for the effectiveness of our mission as well. So from optional to essential. And then I want to make an argument for us moving from just investing in the crowd to investing in a few or the few. I wonder if the pandemic has shaken us a little bit, maybe from our reliance, or at least initially, our reliance in gatherings and crowds, and maybe we began to, you know, wonder how on earth will we disciple people whenever we don't have lots and lots of people together at one time. But for spiritual formation to take place, it's not just reliant on crowds and content, but we need to work hard at developing personal connection and spaces of community. Brent, I think you saw this the other day, but I'll draw it for the rest of people. Okay, these are numbers that are associated with the ministry of Jesus. Okay, we see Jesus with the crowds. He fed them, taught them, ministered to them, had compassion on everyone. There was more than 5,000, wasn't there? But you know what? You know, there was a crowd. There was crowds. Jesus ministered to the crowds. He didn't shy away from that. And then we see in Luke chapter 10 that there was a wider group of followers of Jesus. There was a 70 or 72 whom he equipped in mission, whom he sent out in pairs to reach out to the nearby towns and villages. He gave them a task. They received his instruction and they followed his lead. Then within the 72, we've already had this read for us, there's 12. They're named. They're the kind of inner group of Jesus. But even within the 12, there's these three, Peter, James, and John, and they seem to be with Jesus more than the rest. So they're at the Transfiguration. They're in the Garden of Gethsemane at a key point of need. They're at some miracles. They're just mentioned more. And then there's also times in Jesus' life where he's up a mountain early in the morning at the other side of the lake. He's away from the crowd and he's alone with his Father in prayer. And it's been said before that often the journey that we make is from here to here. Okay? How do we grow it? You know, how do we, often the temptation is we're leaving the place of devotion, neglecting the place of devotion in exchange to be with people. And maybe we're sitting with a small group and we're thinking, how do we grow this? And how do we make it more? And our goal becomes attraction. Okay. Let's get more people. And the question then, if our goal is attraction, then the goal becomes, let's get more people, and our questions become more and more pragmatic. Okay. But by that, I mean maybe practical. And we're often thinking, what will we do to get lots of people in? And then we shape our activities in a way that will get the most people in. As we read the Gospels, so please don't hear me, Jesus invested and spent time in these spaces. But as we read the Gospels, generally it seems that the direction that Jesus walked in was actually from here to here. He was often escaping the crowds to be alone with the 12. Says that, you know, they got on a boat and they crossed to the other side of a lake, and then the crowd were waiting for them over there. They followed them. But Jesus was often trying to escape the crowd. Why? Surely you want everyone to know. Jesus didn't respond to the demands of the crowd at every point. He's leaving the 12 sometimes to be with the 3. And sometimes he's leaving the three in the garden and other places to be alone with his Father. See, this is the way of investment. Not attraction, but investment. And if we read the Gospels, we will see Jesus spend the majority of his time in this space, the one, the three, and the 12. 46 times in the Gospels, we see Jesus with a few. 17 times in the Gospels, there's occasions where he's with the crowd. He invested most of his time here, and yet that he went on to reach the whole world. When often what we do is we try and reach the many, but we do a poor job at investing in the few. What would it look like in our lives and in our ministries to invest more in the core and to invest and to develop a community, to not just seek to grow bigger, but actually seek to go deeper in those who are there? Let me give you the example of this. About 5 or 6 years ago, I was part of a team that was sent out from our church, kind of large suburban church, to plant a church into the city centre of Belfast. We were sent out as a core team of 9 people to plant. And, you know, some of those early days were hard. You know, we met as a core team for about a period of 6 months, and we prayed and we invested in the team, and then we began to open up our gatherings. We'd run a kind of alpha course in the city as well, simultaneously to that, and then we began to open up a kind of weekly gathering. It began just on a Wednesday night, just for kind of worship and prayer, and before we eventually opened on Sundays. But there were some of those Wednesday nights, we were meeting in a theatre downtown in the city centre of Belfast, and we didn't know if anyone else was going to come, you know. Sometimes there was 13 or 14 of us, 9 of them were the core team. And we didn't know who was going to show or who was going to come. And so often that can feel like failure in ministry. Until a pastor from a church actually in Edinburgh came and visited us as a core team and said this. He said, don't focus on the breadth. Focus on the depth and God will take care of the breadth. Don't focus on the breadth or the width. Focus on the depth and God will take care of the breadth. And that for me, it became a lifeline for us as a team at that time. It became a mantra for us as we planted. And not just deep, so deep in discipleship, deep in fellowship as well. We prioritize relationship. We prioritize spiritual formation. We could have gathered a crowd. I think you can gather a crowd. I think it's fairly easy to gather a crowd. You could pick lots of things to do. But we tried to focus our attention on the depth. God has taken care of the breadth. I'm not part of that team anymore. I gave 3 years to that team. Stepped out of it just as we were given a building from an old church that was dying and shutting its doors. And I stepped out at the time that, and just as I stepped out, there was kind of growth that happened. So I don't know what that tells you. They now meet on a Sunday morning in a kind of refurbished church building. There's about 150 or 200 people coming, most of them in their 20s or 30s. God has and is taking care of the breadth, but it's on a foundation of discipleship. And so as people join that church, they know that it's an expectation that they join what's called a community, but essentially a community, a discipleship, a group that's orientated around discipleship. And there are not loads of activities in that church, but it's being built around a culture of discipleship and being really well led by someone who's not me. And so it's just a kind of example. So, but what would that look like for you? What would it look like for you to intentionally not ignore the crowds, not, you know, but actually to intentionally invest? Okay, I've maybe gone on about that. In fact, I've got a cracking quote. Okay, here we go. Robert Coleman, who, if you want to read something on discipleship, The Master Plan of Evangelism by Robert Coleman. Some of you are nodding your head. There you go. You'll like this quote then. He says this, one must decide where he wants his life to count. In the momentary applause of popular recognition or in the reproduction of his life in a few people who will carry on his work after he has gone. It's a question of which generation we are living for. Which generation are we living for? That quote stabs me in the heart so many times. And the popular recognition, sorry, the momentary applause of popular recognition or in the reproduction of our lives in a few people who will carry on the work. Who are your three? Who are your 12 that God might be calling you to invest in and equip them to go and do the same? You know, people are less interested. I firmly believe this. People, I think, are less interested in this next generation in kind of perfection and polish. I think they're desperate for, whether they know it or not, I think they're desperate for deeper community and investment and relationship. I sat last night with a group and I am going off. I'm going to stop, okay? So last little tangent. I'll get you to talk about these two shifts in a moment. But I sat with there's 11 or 12 young kind of interns who are here this week from England. Sat with them last night in the bar after everything, all in their early 20s. And they were beginning to ask a couple of us, you know, who are a little bit older, you know, what would you do? What would you do? And I turned that question around. They were saying, you know, what advice would you give to us young leaders and all this? And passed on a few things. But I turned a question around to them and I said, what are you looking for in us? What are you as a 21-year-old Christian or young leader, what are you looking for in the generation above you? And one girl said, and the rest nodded, she said, honestly, said, I'm just looking for ordinary investment from people. Said, I love it when people get alongside me, listen to me, take an interest in me, believe in me. I think they're desperate and they're hungry for investment. Maybe that's part of our challenge in moving our attention and focus from the crowd to the few.